Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Shares for beginners.
My day-to-day is dealing with people at the front office of ETFs and trying to find what their problems are so that I can resolve it. And I think data insight is a key aspect in that, really, because data doesn't lie.
G'day and welcome back to Shares for Beginners. I'm Phil Muscatello. How are ETFs created and what is an issuer? What's all the paperwork you receive when you first buy a share or ETF? How do ETF providers know if their ETFs are actually fulfilling the needs of investors? To explain all this and more is Ibrahim Hussain. G'day, Ibrahim.
Thanks, Phil. Thanks for having me here.
Thanks for coming along early on a Monday morning.
Thank you so much. I actually love your work. I've listened to a few of your podcasts. So
fantastic.
It's an absolute pleasure being here. Thank you.
Ibrahim is the General Manager of ETFs at Computershare. He has over 15 years of experience in assisting ETF issuers meet their strategic objectives and build solid relationships with their investors. So tell us about how you became interested in finance in the first place. What were you doing, you know, at a young age? What sort of age did you get into it?
Okay, I'm not going to give away my age, but if I have to describe myself, I would describe myself as a front office guy who loves finance. My love for finance goes back at a very young age at school. And what attracted me to the concept of finance is the concept of wealth and value creation. So that pathway took me to university where I studied economic banking and finance. And subsequently, I did an MBA in finance and strategic management. When I was at university, my goal was to actually get into investment banking. That's what I wanted to do. But then I got sidetracked into the financial markets. You know, like everyone else, I always thought that shares and share trading was luck of the draw. You pick stocks here and there, you get lucky sometimes, sometimes you get unlucky. Then I realized there's actually art and science in investment, and that really is what got me to it. But today, really, the aspect that I love the most about my role is dealing with people. I love dealing with people. I love dealing with decision makers in finance. I love dealing with people behind decision makers. I like dealing with people at the coalface and everyone in between. I'm a firm believer of networking. I'm a firm believer that every person that you meet has a potential to add value to your life. Case in point, yourself, Phil. We have met in
a party. That's
at
right.
A party. Not a party. It was a networking event, an ETF network event. And here we are having a cup of coffee and talking about ETFs.
Yeah, well, that dance music was pretty loud, so that party in the background. But like a party to me.
There you go.
So did you when did you first start investing yourself?
What we did at university.
I mean, were you doing it like in that luck of the draw idea? So what? I'll pick that one and buy that stock. Or
at university, we played the ASX game where they give you fake money and you invest in real stocks.
Yeah.
I think this game is still on play today.
It is.
It was part of our assignment. So we were asked to actually invest for a period of 3 months and use the tools that we were taught at school to do that. So I did that. I didn't really do very well, mainly because of market conditions at the time. It kind of gave me the idea, let me just try, throw a few dollars here and there. Obviously, I was a student. I didn't have a lot of money, spare money to invest in. But then I put a bit of money into the stock market using the tools that I had studied at the time. And then I started seeing the results at the time. So I thought of this is a beautiful thing. So going back to what I said earlier, the concept of wealth creation and value creation, I started seeing those outcomes, albeit at a kind of micro level. And I thought, okay, this is not a bad thing. I've got three kids under seven, and I'm trying to kind of teach them that concept of this early. It's never too early.
Do they listen?
All they want is pocket money to go and buy a lollipop. So at this stage,
you're not sort of saying, okay, you've got to save some of these.
Yeah,
and
so
invest it, you know,
they've got piggy banks, obviously, and they understand the concept of saving, but also I'm trying to teach them the concept of not just saving, but actually making that money work for you.
When did you first become aware of ETFs? Because they're quite a new thing in Australia, really, relatively new.
Relatively. We are late adopters in Australia compared to other markets. I was involved in 2007 when Barclays Global Investors introduced their iShares cross-listed ETFs. I was, I think, one of the first cross-listed ETFs in Australia, primarily domiciled in the US and secondary listed here in Australia. It was a very new concept. And I was lucky enough at the time to be involved in that launch project. And that's really was kind of my initiation into the world of ETFs. So I've seen the industry evolve over time to where it is now.
So you work at Computershare now. What is Computershare and how does it touch every investor?
Oh, a great question. Computershare. I've got to ask you a question. Do you know that Computershare was one of the first fintechs in Australia?
I think Scott may have mentioned
you may have
secret. He might have mentioned something about that.
Yeah, but, you know, Computershare is just an incredible Aussie success story. You know, you know, it started from a very humble beginnings, 1978 in Melbourne.
Yeah.
1994, we got listed on the ASX. The market capitalization at that point was $36 million Australian dollars. As a close of market last Friday, the market cap was sitting at around $16.4 billion.
With a B.
Today, we have offices in over 21 countries, employing about 16,000 people, looking after 75 million account holders around the world. What we do, in a nutshell, we attract, engage, and manage our client stakeholders. Those stakeholders could be in the listed space as shareholders or outside of that. That's effectively what we do around the world.
That's one of the things, one of the main things is being a share registry. So when you first purchase a share or an ETF or anything listed on the stock market, Computershare and a couple of other companies, but we won't talk about them, but Computershare is what's known as a share registry. What is a share registry, and tell us about that?
Yeah, so a share registry, as the name implies, is really involved in managing the share registry for a company. So we would, in the example that you provided for a listed company, once an investor has bought shares through the broker, the information are passed on to us, right? And then our role from then on is to manage that relationship with that investor and any other change of ownership as investors buy and sell those securities. Once we have the records, then what we do is we would undertake any activity or corporate events on behalf of the issuer. So if an issuer, say, pays a dividend or issues the reinvestment plan, we would do that on behalf of the issuer. Corporate actions, bonus payments, share allocations, all those things, we do all that. And any subsequent communication as well, like issuance of statements to investors, we would do that on behalf of the issuer. The key kind of aspect in this relationship is that we are the conduit between the companies that are, in this example, that are listed and the investors.
Yeah. So, because it's very confusing for a new investor. They, as soon as they buy their first listed investment, they're going to be getting a number of pieces of a paperwork, and it's from the share registry, it's from their broker, and obviously their CHESS statements as well. Overall, can you explain that process and why it's not as daunting as it might seem in the first place?
Yeah, it's not daunting and it shouldn't. So when you first purchase a share with the broker, there's a process there, which includes your contract note, etc. Then your details are registered with the broker, right? Whilst I've said earlier that the holding information is passed on to us, more often than not, the information that we need for us to manage that account are not passed on to us at that point, which is why Computershare then undertakes an onboarding process. This onboarding process can be done electronically if we already have an email address for that investor. But if it's a brand new investor, then unfortunately we have to initially go out via what we call a welcome paper, where in that welcome paper, we will ask investors to go to our website and provide information that help us to maintain that relationship. So what we would typically do is ask for an email address, banking details, tax file number, and also for ETFs, we would ask them to certify for FATCA and CRS, which these are tax certifications. So they're foreign tax certifications, and I'll explain. So the Australian government has entered into multilateral agreement with other foreign countries or tax offices to exchange information. So that information requires investors in every country to certify where their tax residency is at. So for ETFs, we would normally ask investors to certify whether they're Australian or not. And that's very important for listeners, because if you don't do that, then we would actually pass on that information to the ATO. But if you miss that initial onboarding, we would normally send two other reminders during the year. So don't panic if you've missed any the initial call to action there. So really, the idea is that onboarding process is intended to make sure that it dictates the relationship ongoing. So if an investor doesn't provide the email address, then all future communications are done via paper.
So let's talk about ETFs. What's your definition of an ETF? I mean, we've covered this so many times on the podcast, but I always like to hear everyone's little nuanced view of what their definition of an ETF is.
Look, ETFs are very simple products. And as you know, ETF stands for Exchange Traded Fund. And as the term implies, these are funds that are traded on the stock market. So they have the same characteristics like any other stock. They can be bought and sold through your broker, right? But what they provide that are different to normal stocks is that by buying an ETF, a single ETF, generally speaking, will give you an exposure to a basket of securities, which can be shares, could be commodities, could be fixed income, could be currency, fiat or digital, or any other asset class. The benefit that has for an investor is that it first and foremost reduces transaction costs, right? So if you had to go and buy individual stocks, there are transaction costs associated with that, brokerage fees, etc. By buying an ETF that gives you an exposure of a basket of shares, takes away most of that cost. And also most of the ETFs, depending on the type of ETF, most of the ETFs actually have very low fees. So the management fees are very low. Like, to give you an example, if you purchase an ETF that has a management fee of 10 basis points, you invest $10,000, your annual fee is $10, right? Pretty low. And really the benefits there is also the diversification benefits from that, because using an index ETF as an example, if you look at any particular index, depending on type of the index, you know, the diversification in terms of sectors and industries is quite wide. And also, you have to bear in mind that ETFs are issued by professional fund managers, right? So they've done their research. So you don't have to rely on your own undertaking to invest on single stocks. So you're mitigating a lot of risk through that diversification as well. So the benefits are pretty diverse. And the other kind of key benefits in ETF that most people don't know is the liquidity of ETFs. ETFs have multiple layers of liquidity. So a fund manager, an ETF issuer, would typically appoint a market maker or market makers, multiple. One of the roles among many of the market maker is to provide liquidity. So if you look at a single stock as an example, the liquidity of that particular stock is limited to shares on issue, because most companies are closed-ended securities, right? The shares on market are what they are.
There's no more.
There's no more.
Created. There's just a certain number.
And if the volumes are low, there's no liquidity. It's hard to buy and sell, right? With ETFs, they're open-ended. So one of the roles of the market maker, at the end of the trading day, they'll do the netting. If there are more buyers than there are sellers, then they'll go and create additional inventory. So they'll place an order in. That order will flow through to the likes of Computershare if you are managing that ETF. And then Computershare will issue those new securities to market within a day or two. The benefit of that to ETF investors is that at any given time, no matter what market conditions are, no matter how low the trading volumes on the screen look like, you'll always be able to buy and sell ETFs.
And that's during the day. It's like that, isn't it? Like when you go to buy or sell an ETF on market, you're going to be getting almost exactly what the asset value of the securities behind it is at that particular moment.
Yeah, so the ETFs are tracking an index, or they're tracking an underlying, not just an index, they're tracking an underlying, you know, basket of securities, which could be securities or commodities, as I said earlier. And the idea for an ETF is for the ETF price to really track the net asset value price of the underlying very closely. And one of the roles of the market makers is to make sure through the spreads that the ETF price is tracking as close as possible to the NAV price.
It can be confusing for new investors to come into the market because they see there's so many types of ETFs. Yeah. Can you just give us a quick rundown on those?
Yeah, look, I think the first point I'd like to make is really to your listeners, everyone needs to actually understand their own situation in terms of their investment objectives and goals and risk profiles and so on.
And time horizon yep. as well.
So just everyone needs to go ahead and seek their own advice. So what I'm going to say by no means qualifies as advice because I'm not a qualified advisor. I think we're very lucky in Australia that given we are late adopters of the ETFs, there's quite a lot of choices on the market today. And credit to fund managers who have been very innovative in coming up with products and regulators as well who have been very keen to actually,
facilitate this move,
the issuance of these products. So ETFs, there are different types of ETFs. I think it's important that we talk about them, right? So traditionally, ETFs, are associated with passive ETFs, right? So what that means is the ETFs are passively managed by the fund manager. They're not actively managed, right? So they'll be benchmarked over an index, right? That index could be,
the top 200 stocks.
Top 200 based on capital market capitalization, right? Or it could be sector-related index, right? But they're passive. And because they're passive ETFs, normally they have lower costs.
And passive just means that there's the fund manager is not saying, this particular stock is going to do better than another stock.
Yeah, they're not picking any stock. And the characteristic of the main characteristic of a passive ETF is that the ETF is not intended to beat the market. So it's benchmarked to the market. So the performance of the ETF should more or less equal the performance of the underlying benchmark that it's tracking, right? So that's the main rationale for that.
Yep.
Active ETFs, on the other hand, as the term implies, they're actively managed by the fund manager who, as you have alluded, pick the underlying stock. And the rationale is they intend to outperform the market. So the fees are usually a bit higher there. So that's the kind of the fundamental difference between a passive and active ETF. And then in between, you've got, you may have heard about smart beta ETFs or factor ETFs. So these are kind of halfway housed between the two. And they're usually offered by passive fund managers where they will use an index as an example, but instead in terms of just letting the index follow the weighting of the market capitalization, what they will do is they will use rules-based or factors. So they may just take all the weightings out of capital or market capitalization and use factors to make sure they kind of rearrange the components of the index. And the idea is to make sure that is to kind of outperform the index, right? Yep. And the benefit you get with that is that it's still managed by a passive fund manager. So you get all the benefits of passive managers such as low fees, etc. Yeah, and also you've got, thematic ETFs.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Yeah, thematic ETFs, I mean, they've really become popular, haven't they? And they're trying to address particular investment aims and goals of investors, aren't they?
The thematic ETFs are appealing to people's conscience, right? And also it's targeting mega trends or trends that are coming. So if there is a trend that, issuers think will continue to grow, then, they may build an ETF through that theme, but also through beliefs as well. Like we've seen in, especially in the Northern Hemisphere, there've been a lot of ETFs that are targeting religious beliefs as well. You know, there's a Catholic value ETF, for example. We've seen the first Islamic ETF issued in Australia about a month or so ago. And,
Really? I haven't heard about this. What's that one?
I think it's ISLM is the ticker, if I'm not wrong. Mm-hmm. And it's really kind of appealing to the conscious people's beliefs.
Yeah.
And picking, you know, the underlying that are aligned with people's beliefs. And, you know, we've seen a lot of these are kind of in the ethical kind of...
No, I understand that. I just haven't heard about religious-based ones, yeah. And you mentioned the Catholic ETF.
In the U.S., yeah. So in the Northern Hemisphere, there have been quite a few ETFs. The thematic ETFs are intended to do that as well. So, you know, looking at trends and technologies, climate change, you know, there's a lot of ESG kind of themed ETFs as well that we start to see in the market. So it's the way of the future, and it's part of innovation that ETF issuers constantly churn, you know. So, you know, the possibilities for ETFs is limitless. And I think kind of to round up your question is there's an ETF for everyone, right? Right. So if whether your aim is growth, passive income, or there's an ETF for everybody. And you just need to do your homework, seek advice. I think that's a rational thing to do. And yeah.
I think it's also important to always consider the different types of ETFs in terms of some ETFs, and you alluded previously to this, is some are about income. And you can invest in ETFs that are just set up for income purposes only, which is not, that's the debt markets, isn't it? That's, it's not to do with stock markets. You're going to be earning income from debt markets.
And that's a good point, because if you look at ETFs, like I'll look at the asset classes on offer today, right? So fixed income are relatively new, right? Mm. So they came into market, I think it was around 2010. I could be wrong, but, you know, in that region. And really, the idea was really to give investors access to the debt market, because it's not easy to invest in debt market. So through an ETF, through your brokers on a stock exchange, you can have access to the fixed income, which then provides this passive income component. But I think overall, one of the benefits of ETFs really is it gives Australian investors access to international equity, international shares. Because really, if you think prior to ETFs, you wanted to access shares that are listed, say, in NASDAQ or New York Stock Exchange or other markets, you really had to get a broker who has access to the securities, and the costs would be very expensive. And at times, you're subject to foreign tax, you know, obligations.
And currency movements.
And currency movements, etc. Yeah. But by accessing those ETFs domestically, it just provides that easily. But what we see from the data that we have is that Australians are still underrepresented in the domestic, in international equity. There's a lot of domestic buyers in terms of people just tend to invest in home equity or shares that are domiciled here, pretty much underexposed to international equity. But the opportunities are there. There's quite a lot of ETFs in offer at the moment that provide exposure to international shares. The other thing to bear in mind as well is we are late adopters in Australia, right? Mm. Other markets are a lot mature, and there's lessons to be learned from other markets. So we've got the benefit of hindsight, effectively, by looking at other markets in the Northern Hemisphere and see what they've done. And really, statistically, if you look at the US, things that happened in the US 15 years ago probably are happening today. Mm. So if we look at the data in the US and study that, I think it can help us here. And the other thing as well is the Canadian market. It's very similar to Australia. So I've been kind of paying a lot of attention to the Canadian market just to look at the trend, and the trajectory that the Canadian market has taken is very similar to the trajectory that Australian market is currently going through. So we have an advantage of being a late mover in this.
Is that to avoid mistakes or to...
Yeah, just the pitfalls, and also kind of provide, you know, an opportunity for issuers to see how they can market their products better.
Mm-hmm. Streamlining processes. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So tell us about your job.
Yeah, so my job...
Because this is what we actually started talking about at that that launch party. We won't call it a party.
networking event.
Networking event.
Yeah. Look, my role is obviously our core services is registry services. So we provide all the services that I mentioned earlier. Right, we manage the registry of ETF investors. We are the market leaders in that space. So 80% of all ETF investors in the Australian market reside in our books. Our clients fund managers, issuers in our books are the market leaders. So they have the lion's share of the market, effectively. Mm-hmm. And we have coverage of all asset classes on issue here in Australia. So we've got a pretty big advantage in that space. So we provide all those share registry services. It's like breathing for us. It just happens. We do that really well. Mm-hmm. But what we've been doing well, without kind of tooting my own horn, is that we are trying to take advantage of our market leadership, especially with the data that we have in our database, to make sure that we help the industry. And by that, I mean the issuers and the investors.
So the issuers are like the Vanguards and the BetaShares.
Product managers.
The product, you know, the ones issuing the ETFs.
The fund managers. The fund managers. Maybe I should use fund manager as a term there. So if I take one step back and look at the market structures, right? Our market structure here is very unique in a good way, right? So if you look at the other markets in the Northern Hemisphere, US, Europe, to some extent Asia, the way the registers work or the records on the register, in those markets, they're intermediated, right? So on the register, you'd hardly find name on register. There'll be an intermediary, either a broker, as is the case in the US. There are some direct investment registrations in the US, but it's a very small proportion of holders. The majority will sit under brokers.
Because we're very unique in Australia, aren't we, in terms of the structure of how equities and shares and ETFs are held.
Yeah. Mm. In Europe, it's custodians, and, some of the Asian markets mirror the US market. Mm. In Australia, as you've rightly pointed out, you actually have a name on register. The end investor sits on the register, the majority of the records. So what does that mean, right? If you're an issuer, that means you know exactly who's investing in your product, right? And who sits in the middle, right? Computershare. So Computershare is the conduit between that end investor.
And so you've got a large amount of data to share, haven't you?
Yeah. As I said, 80% of all the investors sit in our register. So what we have done, we have just launched to our clients, so it's not a market launch, to our clients, we have launched a very powerful ETF data insight tool that really tells them who is investing in terms of investor time. Is that mom and dad, retail holder, your listeners, right? Is it a self-managed super fund? You know, is it an institution? And most importantly, what we're telling our issuers is, how are these investors then using your product? Is the asset utilization in line with the conventional wisdom, with what you expect them to do? And the other thing that stands out for me is, like, we've got, you know, all the investors in our universe, the average ETF holding, so how many ETFs each one holds, is about 1.6, right? Once you take out the institution investors, it's one. So the majority of ETF investors only have one. Now, mind you, we manage over 100 ETFs across almost all asset classes in issue in Australia, period. But
so the average investor
is one ETF.
Has one ETF.
Yeah.
Wow.
So
better be a good one.
There's a lot of conclusions to be made of that. I mean, so there's a lot of potential for issuers to really educate the investors, so that investors can actually kind of take advantage of this product. So we are playing a very critical role here in trying to bridge that gap. Because really, if you think about it, we communicate to ETF issuers on average, investors, about 6 to 7 times a year. So there's an opportunity for us to really kind of be that messenger, that passing the information from one to the other to make sure the size of the pie grows. Because unashamedly, you know, we want our the fund managers or issuers to grow their book. But in doing that, we want the investors to also grow their wealth. So it's a win-win-win situation. So that's really kind of what we want to do. The other segment that is worth mentioning is self-managed super fund, right? Data doesn't lie, right? So if you look at the self-managed super fund as a segment, there's about $1 trillion, Australian dollars sitting there, right? Today, I think the asset under management of ETFs is about $129 billion. In our books.
God, it only seems last week it was $100 billion. I've got that magic $100 billion.
It was $50, actually, not long ago. I remember going to an event, a $50 billion event, not long ago. Yeah, so that's pretty significant milestone. So if you look at how many, you know, the percentage of self-managed super fund based on assets in the ETFs in our universe, it's less than 5%. And if you think
so, hang on, that number is less than 5% of
the assets. Yeah,
of assets in super self-managed super funds, or
less than 5% of ETF assets are from super are invested in super self-managed super fund, to be precise. And to me, when I look at self-managed super funds, without being biased, I think ETFs is tailor-made for them, right? Low costs, large exposures, no-brainer, right? But the challenge for ETF issuers, as it is for retail investors, is that it's a very fragmented market. So what can we do then to kind of give issuers access to this for them to actually dip into that $1 trillion that is sitting there? So there's a fair bit of work to be done. But I think on the bright side, there's a great opportunity, I think, for ETF issuers to get into that space, and also opportunity for self-managed super funds to kind of get into the ETFs, because really there's a lot of choices there, as we mentioned throughout this podcast. There's quite a lot of choices for them. So I think it was important to kind of mention that. And also the other thing that's worth mentioning as well is that the retail investment in ETFs just grown exponentially, you know? And I'm sure you would probably notice that, but it's really great. And, you know, when you look at Europe as an example, who had a head start to Australia, at the moment, you know, their retail investment is around 20%. In Australia, depending on the metric you want to use, if you look at the assets or on, in terms of number of holders or mum and dads who have come into the ETFs in the last 2 years, that is more than double, right? Smaller parcels, obviously, so they spend between 1,000 and 5,000 in investing. But that also is because there's been quite a lot of retail investment platforms that have come to market that are assisting, you know, investors in investing in these.
And so many small brokerages and so forth that are encouraging long-term, no-brainer investing by using ETFs as the core of the investment strategies.
So that has been really helpful. What we see from the data in terms of new holders coming in, it's a bit interesting because what you see, one of the pitfalls that you see as well is an investor who already holds single stock ETFs will jump into an ETF. They will invest in an index ETF, for example, that already holds the shares already have. All of a sudden they become overweight in those shares, and they don't do their due diligence and rebalance their portfolio. That can be a little bit tricky.
Yeah, and that's really important. And fortunately, there's portfolio tracking tools these days, which will show this. And, you know, we've had people from those organizations on this podcast to talk about that. And so just make sure you're not overweight, you know, you're not correlating too much between your investments. It's
It's basic stuff. But it's the industry is heading the right direction. So, that's a long-winded way of answering your question, what I do day-to-day. So I'll as I said at the top of the call, is my day-to-day is dealing with people at the front office of ETFs and trying to find what their problems are so that I can resolve it. And I think data insight is a key aspect in that, really, because data doesn't lie.
Just before we finish off, I just wanted to talk about in share registry services and in ETFs. And this is boring, I know. Yeah. I know, people, this is really boring. But I think it's amazing that at the end of every financial year, your ETF provider will issue a statement showing you exactly the tax implications of what your holding means, which you can just give to your accountant. Can you just describe that piece of paper for me? I mean, I'm just giving you an overview. I don't even know what the correct technical term is for that.
Yeah, so the correct technical statement will be an AMA tax statement. It is just a tax statement. So ETFs pay distributions. So they, for lack of a better term, they're like dividends. I think a lot of you listeners will be familiar with dividends.
Yeah.
They pay distributions, which really is, you know, if you invest in an ETF, all the income and capital gains from the underlying securities are distributed to unit holders, the ETF holders. And at the end of the year, those are kind of calculated and a tax statement is produced.
And some of them have franking credits and some have got international taxation implications. Yep. And all of those things are all summarized in this document, aren't they?
Yeah. So the income will have all the components that are in there, whether you're talking about domestic imputation credits or foreign imputation credits, if relevant, capital gains and so on. So that information is calculated. And these days, because we actually send that information electronically to the tax office. So if investors are doing, they're kind of going to the ATO and do a self-service tax return themselves, you know, that information is already fed to the ATO. So they don't need to actually print a piece of paper and refer to it, right? Those, you know, statements that mail or email to them for reference purposes, but they don't really need it because these days everything is sent to the ATO electronically. So when investors file their tax return, the ATO already has that.
It's auto-filled in there, isn't there? Yeah.
Yes, and if you're doing a pre-fill, as I mentioned, that information is already there. So yeah, it's fairly automated, and ATO has done a lot of progress in data matching. So the days of you printing your dividend advisors and filing them, and at the end of the year, giving them to your tax accountant, are long gone these days.
Yeah. Mm. Ibrahim, thank you very much for joining me today.
Phil, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you.
If you found this podcast helpful, please tell a friend, especially if it's someone who needs to start thinking about investing for their future. You'll be helping them and helping me to keep this show on the road.
Shares for Beginners is for information and educational purposes only. It isn't financial advice, and you shouldn't buy or sell any investments based on what you've heard here. Any opinion or commentary is the view of the speaker only, not Shares for Beginners. This podcast doesn't replace professional advice regarding your personal financial needs, circumstances, or current situation.
And thank you for listening to my podcast.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.